special guest, Professor Lisa Poirier. Say hi.
Hello.
Yes, and we are going to talk about everything David Bowie. We're going to do some analysis of his songs, talk about his personas, his collaborations, and play plenty of Bowie in between. So I'm sitting here right now in the studio, not that you can see it. I have a mullet on and I'm dressed up as Jareth the Goblin King from Labyrinth and spiritually Professor Poirier. What are you today?
Well, actually, I'm wearing blue, and it's the specific shade of blue that David Bowie wore when he was on Saturday Night Live in 1979 doing TVC15 with Klaus Nomi and Joey Arias.
So these are the personas that we're doing today. All right. I wanted to talk a little bit about those. I'm assuming that that's your favorite Bowie persona.
Without a doubt, yeah.
All right. And mine is clearly the Goblin King. That's why I'm walking around in the yoga pants and the waistcoat. So I just, there's something about his personas that is uniquely organic, if that's the word that I'm looking for. They feel authentic. What do you think makes them so real?
Well, I think maybe it's his acting skills. I don't know. He commits when he is being a particular persona. He's in it 100%.
Yeah, I feel like part of it, too, is as he transitioned through different periods of his life, that's when kind of the persona shifted. So Ziggy Stardust was kind of when he was coming onto the scene, you know, all the excesses that come with fame. And then the Thin White Duke was kind of spiral out. You know, I feel like that persona in particular was kind of a manifestation of what he was going through at that point in his life.
I think that's a really good observation. I think definitely these personas were linked to experiences that he was having.
Yeah, and I think, you know, part of that is he didn't kill off the Thin White Duke. Like, he announced in concert that he was going to retire Ziggy Stardust and he was going to bring out Aladdin Sane instead. That persona kind of just emerged and then disappeared with no one talking about it. So it was definitely, I think he said in an interview that it was one of the darkest periods of his life, which would explain why he was this very gaunt, you know, you could say arguably kind of fascist character.
Ooh, fascist. That's quite something to level, right?
Yeah, I mean, we're going to talk about that a little bit further on when we talk about China Girl. That's, spoiler alert, that's going to be a couple segments from now. But, you know, when he was doing interviews at that point, was it really acting, or do you think it was actually him kind of spiraling?
I have absolutely no idea, but I bet you have an opinion and I can't wait to hear it.
I truthfully can't tell you. I think it could be a little bit of both. You know, looking back, he said that, you know, he absolutely kind of took back some of what he said and he claimed it was acting, but I don't believe him. I don't think he was acting at that point, you know, because he went to Berlin to go get clean with Iggy Pop. And I think that, you know, his experiences as the Thin White Duke were kind of as a result of the cocaine-induced psychosis.
Oh, wow. So you think it was drugs that just pushed him over the edge?
I do. A combination of drugs and illness, because at that point, that's when he was doing the subsisting on milk and peppers and cocaine, and that was all. So I think that
not a diet I'd recommend.
No, not at all. To all of you listening, please don't do that. We're not endorsing this. And I don't think David Bowie would at this point either, although he can't endorse it at this point. But we're going to pretend that he's not dead. So, yes,
I'm up for that.
Yeah, we'll speak about it in the present. Black Star was never released. So
I can work with that.
Awesome. All right. So because this is a literary podcast, you know, I want to talk a little bit about, in books, certain authors will use personas in order to kind of get across their message more. Like if you read The Help, for example, it flips between different personas to show different experiences within the book. So I know that you're not an English professor, but what advice or what inspiration do you think that writers can pull from David Bowie and committing to his personas and living as his personas?
Wow, I think maybe that's the key word, isn't it? Commit. If you're going to come from a particular perspective, you've got to go all in. That means do your research, right? You can't make up a persona out of, you know, nothing. You have to ground it in some kind of verifiable historical experience. So it seems to me that research would be the key.
I agree with you on that, because I think the most convincing personas are the ones where the authors know what they're talking about. They kind of have pulled information that's around them. They've kind of looked at the history of when their character would be. Obviously, this is going to be a little bit different if they're existing in a purely fantasy world.
Sure.
But even then, contextualizing it within the universe that they're in, I know that this is departing from Bowie. I'm so sorry. But, you know, Brandon Sanderson, for example, creates these huge fantasy worlds, and he contextualizes his characters. Okay, this character is going to represent the religious aspect. This is the ruling aspect, the magic aspect.
Yeah, so, I actually have a pal who consults for folks who want to create worlds in, like, you know, video games or fantasy writing. And he actually uses scholars from theory and method and religious studies to help people shape these environments. So, you know, you've got to know how these things work if you want to make up a new one, right?
That is the coolest thing.
Yeah, it's a great job. Wish I had it.
I know. That would be so much fun. It would be like doing D&D character creation all day for a living.
Mm-hmm.
I wish. Anyways, I talked about creating magic or contextualizing within magic, and that leads me to our first song break. I'm sitting here dressed up as Jareth the Goblin King. The mention of the word magic should tell you what we're going to play. It has no literary merit, but it's my podcast. Try and stop me. We're going to play Magic Dance from the movie Labyrinth.
It's a babe.
What babe?
Babe with the power. Power of voodoo.
Voodoo.
You do.
Do what?
Remind me of the babe.
I saw my baby cry before this babe could cry.
What could I do?
Dance, magic, 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 dance, magic
All right, we're back in. That was Magic Dance from the movie Labyrinth. While we were taking a break so that you could listen to that wonderful song with, again, no literary merit, the question came up of who actually wrote it. Even more intriguing, who made the baby noises? So that is something we may never know. But David Bowie did it.
I hope he sat in the studio and practiced making baby noises.
You know what? I could see that happening. I love that mental image. Yeah, it's amazing. Even better if he does it in costume.
Sitting with his little magic balls from the labyrinth making baby noises.
Mm-hmm. Oh my God. I need like a print of this or something. Bowie actually wrote and then produced all of the songs from Labyrinth. I did not know that until recently, because if you look at the credits for the soundtrack, it credits a couple of other artists on there who did more of the instrumental things. But if you liked that song and you love movies with really weird reject Muppets, ethically controversial love stories, heartwarming sidekicks, and David Bowie in yoga pants.
And a baby.
Oh, yes, and a baby in a red and white striped onesie that gets thrown into the air multiple times.
Very dangerous.
It is, but it's great. Labyrinth is going to be back in movie theaters this weekend, so you can pick up your tickets. I think that they're doing an extended version of it, so they have like interviews with some of the creators, which is going to be fantastic. They also encourage you to come in costume. So if, like me, you happen to have a Goblin King costume laying around, put it on and go see Labyrinth. All right, so our next segment is going to be talking about things with actual literary merit, because, of course, David Bowie did do some things that you can argue don't have much value besides being fun music, but a lot of his stuff, I think, was very... I don't know what the phrase is that I'm looking for, like sophisticated.
Yeah, I think his work is very thoughtful.
Yeah. So we're going to first look at Space Oddity, which is the song that really launched him in his career. It came out in 69 with his first record, and then they actually went, renamed the record, and re-released it in 72 as Space Oddity, as everyone knows it. And it's kind of the beginning of his fascination with space, the occult, and the other. So we're going to play a couple of clips so that you kind of know what we're talking about.
Ground control to Major Tom. Ground control to Major Tom. Take your protein pills and put your helmet on. Ground control to Major Tom.
7, 6.
Commencing countdown, engines on.
3, 2.
Check ignition and may God's love be with you.
Oddity that I wanted to play. If you're not familiar with the song, that's part of the beginning of it. Major Tom. At least when I was a kid, I thought that Major Tom was actually an astronaut. As I grew up and learned about metaphors, my heart broke. But we're going to pretend that Major Tom's actually an astronaut today. This is kind of, I know that this is not what the song was intended to be about, but knowing that this was the song that kind of jump-started his career and started to make him the global sensation that he was, it's kind of interesting that he's doing the countdown at the beginning, you know, commencing countdown, engines on.
I see. Yeah, you launch as a metaphor, sure.
Yeah.
I think it really did break him into the U.S. market, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And even if it's not intended to be that way, I mean, we can still kind of,
sure,
it can be our headcanon for the day.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So this is almost kind of the beginning of his fascination with space. I mean, how many different songs can you think of his that reference exploration or the other or space? You know, there's a lot.
I put him on every space playlist I make because he is the spaceman.
Really?
Yeah.
Interesting.
I mean, he's the Starman, definitely.
Yeah, Starman.
So there was the entire album, Ziggy Stardust and the Spiders from Mars.
Mm-hmm.
Although the Spiders from Mars were not actually from Mars. they were a band. So that's disappointing.
Well, still, we've got a space reference.
We do. Lady Stardust and the Starman were from space. Mm-hmm. And if you listen to the entire progression of the album, you know, he gets torn apart by either the Starman or his fans at the very end. Mm-hmm. So,
and concept even, album in that sense, yeah.
Yeah. I feel like it's probably one of the most blatant concept albums that he did.
Yeah, you know, I think so.
Yeah, a lot of them addressed other themes that he did, but this one was unique.
Yeah, I think it was certainly his first successful foray into that conceptual, you know, the entire album hangs together. I would think Lodger would be another example of that, where, you know, that's entirely travel themed, mm-hmm. but the persona is clear, I think, in Ziggy Stardust. So...
yeah. We're going to play another clip from Space Oddity. It sounds like it's, you know, when you listen to it, it's a very almost flat, emotionless songs. And yet it's very actually emotional at certain points in it. Not going to ruin the song if you don't know it, but something very terrible happens to Major Tom.
Spoiler alert.
Yeah, I'm not going to say what, but I think you can guess because he's in space.
Major Tom to ground control. I'm stepping through the door, and I'm floating in a most peculiar way, and the stars look very different today. For here am I sitting in a tin.
That is the second clip that we wanted to play from Space Oddity. Clearly, terrible, terrible things happened to Major Tom, which, again, really upset me when I was little because I thought he was this brave astronaut.
Aww.
I also thought that the spiders from Mars were actual spiders from Mars, though, so that says something. There is another song. We're trying to remember the name of the man who wrote it right now. It is Peter Schilling. Thank you, Dad. My dad's in the studio with us. Hi, Dad. Peter Schilling decided that he was going to go and write almost a sequel to Space Oddity called Major Tom, in which he brings Major Tom back home. Like, he confirms that Major Tom is alive. But I feel like that almost cheapens the story.
Yeah, I think he blew it.
Yeah, I think it's a sad attempt at fan fiction. I'm sorry, Peter Schilling, but I don't like it. We're next going to talk a little bit about China Girl, which is, I think, one of Bowie's most fascinating songs. Professor Poirier, a lot of the classes that you teach are about colonialism and culture and religion, so I think that you're going to have a field day with this one.
The themes are right there.
They are. They're very blatant. It's almost kind of awkward when you're in the gym singing along on the treadmill. Like, you need to be very careful what you're doing.
Oh.
Yeah. So we're going to play the bridge from China Girl for you, so you know what we're talking about. Take a listen.
Town, just like a sacred cow, visions of swastikas in my head, plans for everyone. It's in the way of my eyes. My little China girl, mess with me, I'll ruin everything you are. You know, I'll give you television, I'll give you eyes of blue, I'll give your man a wise to rule the world. And when I get excited.
All right, there is a lot to unpack in that one.
There sure
is. He's very blatant. My first response, or my first reaction, you know, when I heard the song for the first time, after I knew a little bit more about David Bowie, was almost that he is kind of revisiting the Thin White Duke character in a very subtle way.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, because he, you know, he talked about in interviews with that character about, you know, these. Far-right kind of fascist imperialistic movements. You know, and again, I could be completely incorrect in this, but it just kind of reminded me of that character that he described as being very dark.
But it's certainly a critique in this song, isn't it?
Oh, I mean, absolutely.
He's not recommending swastikas.
No, he is not. If any of you are listening and want to recommend that, David Bowie says no, please don't. So let's, you know, let's look at the first part and kind of, because I feel like there's almost two separate parts of the bridge. You know, the I stumble into town like a sacred cow, visions of swastikas. Do you think, you know, that this is kind of a reference to colonialism being dominated by like traditionally European, Caucasian, white, however you want to phrase it, culture?
I would definitely interpret it that way, without a doubt. I mean, when I just hear that phrase, I think of the British occupation of India, and of course, you know, David Bowie being a UK kind of guy himself. I think that would be one of his first go-tos as well when he thinks about British imperialism. Yeah.
Absolutely. I didn't even think about that. I completely forgot about that. Yeah. And then, you know, the second part, he's talking about, I'll bring you television, I'll bring you eyes of blue. It's almost talking about how the globalization of media is kind of accelerating this, but in more subtle ways. It's not so much I'm going to go occupy a country now. It is in some cases, but more often than not, influences spread through media.
And sure.
Yeah.
I think he's definitely talking about cultural imperialism there.
Yeah.
And the two go hand in hand, right? And also, I think of, I'll give you Eyes of Blue, that always reminded me of the Bluest Eye. Right, by Toni Morrison.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I haven't read that one.
It deals with the same issues about, in that case, it's about racism in the U.S. But some of the same themes are there.
It could maybe be seen almost as talking about not necessarily racism, but maybe the fetishization of Asian culture, particularly Chinese culture, perhaps.
And the setting up of, you know, Europeanness and whiteness as the norm. I think that's what's going on in both places.
Yeah. I think it's also a little bit ironic that this this song is coming from David Bowie, considering he was a global superstar. It almost feels like he's part of the movement that he wants to warn about. You know.
Well, yeah, think about David Bowie's eyes, though, right? think about his double vision. Mm-hmm. Think about how he's got two perspectives on things. Think about there's a David Bowie and then there's a persona David Bowie. And that's that allows, I think, for a lot of room in interpretation. And yeah. I think that's part of his genius.
We're getting philosophical here. Yes. I wanted to have a philosophy segment, but I thought it might take too long. But
oh, no, we're going to get there.
We're doing it here. Oh, yes. Yeah. No, that absolutely makes sense, though, that he can simultaneously be part of the industry, be part of the cultural imperialism, and yet be able to critique it. And I don't want to throw the phrase Bowie magic around lightly, but I think that it's, you know, it's almost a sign of the Bowie magic that he can do one thing, say the other, almost kind of make a statement within what he's doing. Mm-hmm. You know, it's the Bowie magic. All right. Speaking of David Bowie magic, we're going to play Magic Dance again. No, I'm sorry. We're not. We're going to do the sequel to Space Oddity and not the Peter Schilling one, because, again, I do not accept that Major Tom is alive. I wish he was, but he's not. We're going to play Ashes to Ashes off of the album Scary Monsters, which kind of talks about how David Bowie, I feel like David Bowie and Major Tom are kind of the same person in Ashes to Ashes.
I think he's definitely setting up that comparison in Ashes to Ashes. And he is on purpose sort of, you know, going back to Major Tom and talking about what really happened, right, in his life.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. So this is Ashes to Ashes.
We'll be right back.
We are back. That is one of my absolute favorite David Bowie songs. You know, not even because we get to hear a little bit about what happened to Major Tom. Not that we wanted confirmation, but we got it. Mm-hmm. But it's, you know, it feels a little almost experimental at points, you know.
I think it's another one of his lyrical scores, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, he's doing so well lyrically on this.
Yeah.
Right? He really found the groove on this song.
He did. And I remember reading, he talked about when writing it, he wanted it to almost be like a fairy tale for the 80s.
Mm.
I feel like his fairy tale for the 80s was Labyrinth, but we'll give him Ashes to Ashes.
I think it depends who you were. Maybe if you were your age, then you know, Labyrinth might be the fairy tale. But I think those of us who were, you know, adults in the 80s, or at least young adults in the 80s, maybe Ashes to Ashes is much more applicable.
I think so, mm-hmm. Yeah, because not everyone's, you know, running around trying to save their baby brother and
that's
crossing
right.
the bog of eternal stench.
Never happened to me once.
Yeah, yeah. I feel like you've been deprived of having this experience. We'll make an obstacle course on the quad and call it the bog of eternal stench.
Oh, no.
I think I'm going to have to get paid for this.
I might be able to make that happen. All right, so let's talk a little bit about David Bowie's collaboration. Not that I don't want to further talk about Labyrinth. We can do that anytime. Like, literally, if you're listening to this and you want to talk Labyrinth, let's talk Labyrinth. But David Bowie and his collaborations, I feel, are a very interesting topic, just because he wasn't particularly known for being a friendly, collaborative, yay team kind of person. You know, I read my friend Neil. Hi, Neil, if you're listening, gave me a book for Christmas, and it was a collection of interviews that people had done with David Bowie after he died, and it talked a lot about working with him and his collaborative process. And everybody said, you know, yeah, we feel like we work well with David, but we never felt like we knew him a lot.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it was really interesting hearing that from people, especially because he worked with several people throughout the course of his career.
Definitely, and some of his collaborations produced some really extraordinary work. I mean, I think of his work with Brian Eno, his
Absolutely.
Work with Iggy Pop.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, these are great, productive collaborations.
They are.
Tony Visconti.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah. I can't remember the name of the guy that he worked with for Let's Dance. He was the lead singer of Le Chic, I think was the name of the band. We saw them open for Duran Duran, and he played Let's
oh,
Dance.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Those were very productive collaborations mm-hmm. that I want to mm-hmm. talk about in a minute, but he's not historically known for being a person that gets along well with others.
Well, I think a lot of people, too, who may not know a lot about David Bowie, just think of him as this solo artist. But mm-hmm. in fact, you know, any musical production involves teamwork and collaboration. I just think that at different periods in his life, David Bowie collaborated with different people, and I think these influences showed up in the music itself as well.
Absolutely. And even in some of the artwork on his albums, I remember reading a story Mick Jagger told about how he had gotten an artist to mock up a cover of his newest album, and he showed it to David Bowie, and without asking Mick Jagger, Bowie went behind his back and poached the artist. So
no
that
way.
Yeah, that is
figures.
Yeah, that is like not a nice move. I could say something else, but we're on air. So it's not a good move, though.
No.
So no, Nile Rodgers is the name of the guy. Thank you. Thank you, Michelle. You're the best. Nile Rodgers was the singer of Le Chic. Anyways, yeah, he went and he poached the artist behind Mick Jagger's back. And mm-hmm. I can't remember which album cover he got him to do the artwork for, but he stole Mick Jagger's artist. So,
man.
Yeah. I feel like you almost had to be aware that Bowie was going to be kind of fickle and slightly controlling of what he was working on if you were going to work with him, though, you know?
Well, I think as an artist, he wanted creative control, and he wanted to be able to produce things that were true to his own artistic vision. And I don't think you can blame him for that at all.
No, absolutely not. Mm-hmm. You know, you talked a little bit about Iggy Pop. I want to talk more about that because I feel like that's one of the best, not only collaborations, but friendships that he had in his life. You know, Iggy Pop was institutionalized at a point in his career after his band dissolved. He was institutionalized, and Bowie came to visit him in the hospital and said, hey, let's move to Berlin. So they moved to Berlin and they started to get clean together. And I think it's so interesting. And the Berlin Trilogy came out of that. I think Iggy Pop did help write a couple of the songs for that.
I believe he did. And Iggy Pop today always talks about his gratitude to David Bowie for those days that they spent together.
Yeah, there's a fantastic photo shoot, actually. If you're sitting in front of a computer, I recommend you look it up. It looked like it was done at the same time as the photo shoot for the cover of Heroes. But there's a shot of Bowie and Iggy Pop doing this ridiculous hug, and Bowie has his very, you know, picturesque face, like, I'm posing, I'm modeling, I'm voguing, and then there's Iggy Pop, like, looking like he's screaming. It's just, I love it. It's like the perfect encapsulation.
Yeah, that's perfect juxtaposition of their two modes of being in the world as well. I think my favorite Iggy Pop tidbit in vis-a-vis David Bowie is I remember learning that TVC 1-5, which is of course one of my favorite David Bowie songs, was inspired by a dream that Iggy Pop had about his girlfriend being eaten by a television. And David Bowie took that concept and ran with it lyrically and of course musically in TVC 1-5.
I absolutely love that.
It's a great concept, isn't it?
It is. It's such a great story. Yeah. You know, you can say, yeah, I dreamt about my girlfriend getting eaten and David Bowie made it a song. You know, I wonder how many people wish they could say that.
And such a commentary on media, right?
Yeah.
David Bowie turned it into a meditation on the influence of media in people's lives.
Yes. I wish that I had pulled it for my podcast. I wasn't intending it to come up, but you should definitely look it up again if you're sitting in front of a computer. I've given you a list of things to Google.
I would recommend going for the clip of when David Bowie was on Saturday Night Live in 1979 performing that song with Klaus Nomi and Joey Arias in the background.
This is what you are in spirit right now, Professor
Poirier.
That's
right. I have to make the recommendation.
Yeah. All right. And, you know, China Girl, which we played a little bit earlier, that was written with Iggy Pop.
Yeah.
And I remember reading that Bowie recorded it because Iggy Pop was going through some financial struggles. Mm. And he got some of the royalties from the song being played and everything. So he really recorded it to help his buddy out.
I totally didn't know that.
Yeah.
Wow.
It's so cool. You know, and it's not... There's not a lot of stories about David Bowie like that.
Thank you for being a friend, David Bowie.
Yeah, it's such a good story. And he, you know, he helped produce The Idiot, which is one of the, it's probably the definitive Iggy Pop album. So, yeah.
Pretty exciting.
Mm-hmm. He's also very well known for his collaborations with Freddie Mercury,
True. The
lead singer of Queen.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, I don't know as much about their relationship.
Neither do I.
Yeah.
But that produced one big hit, at least.
It did. again, if you're sitting in front of your computer, as a tribute to Freddie Mercury after he passed, David Bowie performed Under Pressure with Annie Lennox from the Eurythmics. I love her. I am such a big fan of hers. It is a great version of the song. Cannot recommend it highly enough. But we're going to play the version that has Freddie Mercury. This is David Bowie and Freddie Mercury's Under Pressure.
Pressure! people on streets.
So slashed and torn.
That was Vanilla Ice, Ice Ice Baby.
Terrible. Yes. You should apologize.
I'm sorry. Every time I'm listening to the radio, though, when I hear the opening, I'm going to be like, okay, is this David Bowie or am I going to get Vanilla Ice? And am I equally happy with either? It depends on the day. So, yeah, that was Under Pressure. We were talking about how Freddie Mercury was really just an incredible artist. And, you know, this isn't a Freddie Mercury Queen podcast, but I feel like we could almost have another hour, hour and a half dedicated to talking about Queen.
Oh, easily.
Yeah.
Easily.
Bohemian Rhapsody. Mm-hmm. Yes. All right. We're going to move into our last segment, which is kind of the wrap-up of today, the spirit of David Bowie, his influence on culture and society. He's influenced it in so many ways. If you look at some of the designs from Fashion Week, I mean, David Bowie was known for his fashion. He had a song called Fashion, and whenever I hear it in the gym, I need to physically turn my body to the left on the treadmill. Even when I'm mowing the lawn,
because
I have to turn.
Because it's a command.
Exactly.
Turn to
the left. It's not please turn to the left.
No,
it is turn
not.
To the left. You have to. So, you know, it, so much of him was fashion, and if you look at some of the designs from Fashion Week from the past couple of years, I think one designer even got to borrow one of the original Ziggy Stardust jumpsuits.
Really?
Yes. There's a picture. I can't remember the name of the model, but she got to wear it on the catwalk.
That's amazing.
It is. That is, I want to do that. I am probably at least half a foot too short, but I can pretend that I'm David Bowie. I'm doing that right now in my wig.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. I think it's also important to talk about with David Bowie, especially because we were talking about Freddie Mercury and Queen. Kind of his, I don't want to say it, kind of his implicit advocacy, if advocacy is the correct word, for the LGBTQ plus community. I feel like that was so important in so many subtle ways, especially seeing the progress that we've made in society today.
Yeah. I agree. I may sound obsessed with that 1979 TV appearance, but I remember being struck by the fact that here was David Bowie in a pencil skirt. And it was one of the first sort of intentional gender bendings that I'd ever seen on television to that point. And it was really exciting. It showed that here was an artist who was trying to make an impact in a lot of different ways, in his self-presentation, but in what he was saying about the basic structures of society.
Yeah, that is a good performance to be obsessed with, yeah. By the way. You picked well. It's, you know, and it was really important because this was at a time when it wasn't really common to do that.
Not at all.
Had Annie Lennox, but other than them, you know, it wasn't, well, Boy George as well.
But they were later.
They were.
This was 79.
Bowie was really the first one. And Ziggy Stardust, you know, was this bisexual, agendered, I'm going to say, rock star, you know. And I think part of why he made that part of his identity, I think, might have been for controversy, because that was a little controversial at the time.
Sure.
Especially because in later interviews, he kind of shied away from the label of bisexual.
Mm-hmm.
But I still feel like that was a big part of his identity in ways, even if he wasn't as open with it towards the end.
Regardless of whether that was a part of his claimed identity, it was still something that his audience received from him. I think that folks all over the spectrum of gender and sexuality took really important lessons from David Bowie about how it's okay to be. I think there was a lot that he was putting out there, not just lyrically, but in terms of his self-presentation, that was inspirational and reassuring to a lot of people.
Yeah, and a lot of artists cite him. Obviously, a lot of artists are going to cite him as their inspiration. Zoe pulled up a list in which he was named the 39th most important musician out of the top 100. We disagree. We think that's a little bit low.
That is way low.
I'm going to put him at least top 15.
On our own list.
Like, minimum.
Absolutely.
Yes, I disagree with that list. Mm-hmm. You are wrong. Come fight us in the studio.
We'll punch you in the throat.
No, we can't say that.
So, Rolling Stone, do not come to the studio.
Please
don't.
We will
not punch you. We respect you.
I would never.
You're wrong on this particular topic. Which is okay. We're allowed to disagree.
That's right. In a civil fashion.
Yes. Well, like I was saying, though, I lost my train of thought.
we were just talking about gender and sexuality.
Yes.
And
there are several artists that have cited him as their inspiration. Notably, Adam Lambert is one of the most openly gay artists that we have right now. Saint Vincent is very open with that as well. And if you listen to some of her albums, you can definitely see the Bowie influence.
Oh, sure.
Birth in Reverse is a song that I can think of right off the top of my head. The guitar, I think, would be at home in some of the David Bowie songs.
Interesting.
Yeah, or even there's kind of a surreal feeling to some of her music. If you listen to Surgeon is the song that I'm thinking of right off the bat. And even if that one doesn't necessarily sound like a David Bowie song, there's still kind of that surreal other feeling to it.
Hmm.
You know, you can really see how Bowie has been influential in her career.
Well, also about St. Vincent, each album really does have a different persona, almost very similar to Bowie in the sense, especially with her newest album, Mass Seduction. It's a very different, sleek pop star in comparison to some of her other more ethereal iconography within that.
Absolutely, yeah. I think that my favorite Saint Vincent was probably when she was on SNL. There's a lot of acclaim for the SNL performances here. But, you know, she got on there with her guitar and it looked, you know, you could see there was a little bit of Lady Gaga, there was a little bit of David Bowie. It was fantastic.
Mm.
You know, and Lady Gaga has cited, I'm a huge Lady Gaga fan, she was going to come up at some point today. you know, she cited Bowie as inspiration and as an influence. And if you look at photos of her during her Fame era, her very first album, when she was kind of discovering her style and her sound, she did the Aladdin Sane Lightning Bolt on her face.
Oh, well, there you go.
Yeah, I love it. I think she described herself as the, you know, the theater kid that was running around trying to be David Bowie, you know, and that's a good thing to be. So,
I think a lot of folks, when they're young, they try and be David Bowie.
Oh, yeah.
Absolutely.
Good luck. Go for it.
I mean, I'm doing that right now. Like, I bought the mullet online. Oh, yes.
Step one. Yeah.
We're coming to the end of the podcast, so I just wanted to say a couple of thank yous for the people who have made this possible. Firstly, Monica and Aaron, the EDGE coordinators for the Writing Center. You guys are amazing for approving this crazy project. I can't believe I got away with doing this. The EDGE team, in particular Zoe, for coming in, working the board, answering my questions, like when I'm texting her frantically or running over at the Writing Center. Thank you so much to the Scrawl team for letting me do this. I appreciate it so much. My family for, I know that sounds really cliche, but I legitimately want to say thank you because I've talked about this podcast for months and months and months, and I've called you like every day to talk about it and talk about the costume and everything. My dad is in the studio right now. I already said hi, Dad, but hi, Dad. So, yeah, thank you to my mom, Jeremy. He's not a big David Bowie fan. He's skipping the Labyrinth showing on Sunday. Public shaming. Mm-hmm. You should come with. But, you know, my Aunt Michelle, my aunt and uncle Dan and Therese, you guys really helped get me into David Bowie. I have had Scary Monsters and Low on repeat for this entire week. And also I want to thank, you know, my friends in Alabama, Neil and Cole, for listening to me talk incessantly about this. And that wraps up the cliche thank yous. Oh, and Professor Poirier, you came on the podcast on a Friday.
Of course. So, to talk about David Bowie with you, yeah. Hannah, I wouldn't miss it.
Oh, thank you. So our last song is going to be Rebel Rebel, because that really, I feel like, is the best encapsulation of David Bowie's spirit that you can possibly have in a song.
Such a great song.
It is. You know, it talks about the alternative gender expression, the being a little bit punk, rebelling.
It's punk before punk was punk.
Yes. And even if Halloween Jack is probably not the first thing that you think of when you think punk, it was punk, eye patch and all.
Sure.
So thank you for listening, everybody. Thank you for tuning in. The regular hosts will be back next week. So if you miss them, they will be back, I promise. Thank you for tuning in, and this is Rebel Rebel.